if you care about the internet, you really need to care about open video, whether that means the technology behind open video or all of the kind of legal issues around content or all the issues about just kind of creative and participatory production.
Is there life for video beyond YouTube? The answer to this question and more on this week's Radio Berkman. In the 15th century, a German goldsmith named Johannes Gutenberg invented the first modern printing press, permanently changing how people communicated and sparking too many cultural revolutions to count. Literacy and education were put in the hands of the common person, torn down were the barriers between the author of a text and a mass audience. Ideas once handed down from religious and political leaders, tales handed down by oral tradition, all found new vitality in text, and gained strength as more people were exposed to words on paper. Some suggest that we are going through a similar revolution today in video. We can't point to a singular figure like Gutenberg. Some might point to the inventors of YouTube, others to the creators of super cheap media technology like the Flip Minnow, video phones, and iMovie. Regardless of who takes the credit, it's now as easy to shoot, edit, and distribute a video today as it is to write a blog post, news article, or the great American novel. The implications of this are still working themselves out, even as the technology is maturing. Legal questions need to be answered. How can someone with a video camera have the legal freedom to shoot without harming the privacy rights of others? And their political questions. Will I have the right to remix and borrow from another person's work? And technical questions. Are the platforms and codecs open enough for developers to build the next generation of video on the web? All of these questions got a fair shake at June's first annual Open Video Conference in New York City. Tangled in the web of issues floating around at the conference were several folks from the Berkman Center. We're lucky to have three of them sit down with us for a post-conference roundtable. Amar Asher, Chris Peterson, and Catherine White.
Thank you guys for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
We were talking earlier about what open video means, and it sounded like there's a lot of debate over what open video means even within this conference. As a person who works with video and digital media, even I can't like claim to know anything about it. So did either of you take away any kind of sense of what open video is and why it's important?
I think when I came to the conference, I was expecting it to be specifically quite technical and a lot of people with backgrounds in maybe getting the video up onto the web or, you know, creating the video. But the thing that struck me was that the huge diversity of people there, ranging from, you know, the EFF to Mozilla to journalists who often reported stories that were maybe not in the mainstream news. And it seemed to be that the conference was a great place for anyone involved in content, getting the content up there or creating the content, or things that happen because of the content that's been put up there came together.
So there it sounds like there are a lot of threads of like content creators and technological wizards coming together. Did they actually intersect? Were there people, you know, having debates over what kind of content should be within the so-called open video thread or something like that? Or was it, what was going on?
I'm not sure they ever totally intersected in a way where the multiple threads that we had crossed and knotted into one sort of discrete take-home message. You know, you had the Mozilla guys, we were talking about this earlier, right? You had the Mozilla guys up there talking about why it was important to have an open standard and why, you know, everybody should use OGG. And you had Amy Goodman talking up there about how there should be an open sort of political message and we should be moving away from sort of a corporate mainstream top-down system. And you can see where those interconnect in the section in the sense that, you know, when you move away from plugins, when you move away from licensing structures, when you give everybody the tools to create video and to create content, to share that content, you end up enabling the sort of move away from a corporatized mass media structure. Certainly, they wanted people to go to the conference and come out there and really fight for open video and support OGG and do that sort of stuff. But I think what they really wanted to do was sort of get a bunch of smart people together in the room, have them talk about and share their ideas from the little far-flung reaches where they work and think, and see what other people are building and what they can build together.
One thing that your comment reminded me of, and I don't know if either of you were in this session, but it was a session moderated by Jonathan Zittrin, and he was talking to the founder or the CEO of Boxy. And Boxy is sort of, I think, a really interesting example because it's the intersection of a lot of different issues. You had the content creator and the network issues that were coming at it from, you know, the institutional perspective, and then you've got the legal perspective. And there was a comment I think the CEO had made about the size of televisions, where, you know, it's on the computer, the networks didn't really seem to mind that their video stream was being fed through there. But once literally the size of your monitor went up to like a flat screen, that's when people got really pissed off. And so I think that, you know, just as a microcosm that brought up issues of legality, of net neutrality, of content creation, of innovation on the internet, I think that was one where, you know, that's the reason why this conference is interesting, because it could bring together an academic moderating panel with somebody in the industry who was an entrepreneur with an audience that were, you know, you were the consumers, but also the interactors, especially for somebody really new on the scene. So I don't know. I found that illuminating.
Yeah, and it sounds like there's from what you're saying, there is a kind of consumer angle about this that is really important. If you've got a consumer using something like Boxy, which is a piece of software that allows you to watch a lot of different kind of content streams on a number of different platforms, that's their goal, and they're being blocked by the content creators or the, you know, other sources, then you've got an unstable market for video content, and a consumer might just throw up their hands and say, okay, well, I'm just going to go with what's reliable, which for me may be pirating, or it may be just getting my TV over the air and dealing with it.
There were some very interesting issues thrown up about piracy, and Matt Mason, who authored a book called The Pirate's Dilemma, he gave a very interesting keynote about how one thing that's really happening is that established companies that are dealing with piracy, sometimes it's best to look at what the pirates are doing and actually copy them. And yeah, you know, and this conference was good for things like that. You know, like, hang on a minute, what do you mean? And he spoke a lot about the radio stations in England, which were off the coast because they were pirate radio stations. But that, you know, they have such a big audience now in London that they're sort of, you know, established people are kind of following what they do. And so I found it interesting, the conference interesting, not just from the point of looking at the kind of how things are shaking out in this new video era with all these, you know, different types of video codec and different companies using different models, but also how to deal with, you know, certain legal issues of infringement and but how you actually deal with it in the real world. And
was there anybody there who was just saying, couldn't we just keep things the way they are? Couldn't we just freeze at where we were in 1995 or whenever and just not have to deal with these issues? Because the laws were there that were protecting us. We were making a ton of money. And we didn't have anybody infringing on our rights.
I think given that the last keynote speaker at the very end of the conference was Peter Sund of the Pirates Bay, did anyone else remember anyone advocating the old model?
Purposefully or not, you know, you didn't have a lot of people from the big content providers. Although I think I remember them saying at the beginning that they had invited a wide swath of people.
Really?
And that not, you know, a number of them didn't show up. And I do remember that the people that they had, some guy there from YouTube, a woman there from Adobe, who was defending Flash, and so I, you know, there was a bit of a lion's den.
That was a great panel.
Moment, yeah, that was a good panel.
It was really good.
And that's the sort of that Flash panel versus, you know, the kind of the with the Daily Motion guys, and I forget who else, and YouTube was up there, and I thought that was a really interesting thing, because I kind of wonder to what extent this is that important of a question to people who are actually out there creating content. But you know, there's like this huge debate going on right now as to whether Og, Theora, is it Theora? Theora. We'll go with Theora. Bluff my way out of it.
Yeah.
Or whether Theora or H.264 is going to be the next big thing, the big standard. And
for those who don't know what Og and Theora, or Og Theora and H.264 are, what's a quick like introduction of what they are?
My understanding is that they're different ways of basically encoding the video, and the big difference between them is that Theora is built and anybody can use it. It's built by the open source community, etc. And H.264 is licensed by the MPEG patenting group, just like the DVD standards. And the practical upshot being that if you want to build software that plays with H.264, you have to clear patents with this licensing group and you have to pay them royalties.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so the obvious move in the open source community is to move away from that into developing the AUG model. The thing that I'm wondering is whether consumers, in the Larry Lessig example, right, the kid sitting at home making an anime music video on iMovie, I don't want to say cares in a belittling sense, but if that's really a concern that's salient to them, or if they really experience something that's really limiting them, it seemed to me like the debate between codecs is very distinct from, you know, a media means of production in the Amy Goodman, you know, vein, in the let's upend traditional media structures.
Right, because if you're the average person with a camera, you just want to make it, you just want it to work, look good, and right. be easy to use.
Right, and perhaps this conference wasn't targeted at the person on the street, it was targeted at this select group of individuals who were trying to cross-pollinate their ideas and build something for the HTML5 spec and see where we're going to go from there. Because obviously, you know, Mozilla has been pushing forward for using, trying to figure out what they're going to use in HTML5 and what they're going to promote and whether they're going to favor Theora or H.264.
Which is a big deal because right. once they nail that down in HTML5, right. that decides, okay, well, Internet Explorer, Safari, Firefox is going to go with this same...
Right. Now, Google Chrome supports both, and I believe Safari will not support AUG because Apple is a big stake in H.264. And IE, you know, Microsoft is 10 years behind and it's irrelevant. So I know Facebook is getting into this debate right now because... they're obviously an H.264 system and they have a big stake in that with their Facebook video platform, which is expanding so rapidly. And YouTube at the same time is also, you know, the big player where all their stuff is H.264. On the other hand, Dailymotion, which is the second biggest video platform on the web behind YouTube, is switching all their stuff over to AUG. And I know here at the Berkman Center, we've been switching a lot of the stuff over, to AUG. So it's not clear to me whether this is going to hit a tipping point in favor of the open source codecs. But at the same time, I also don't know how much it necessarily matters to people who are actually going out there and doing the political citizen journalism creation.
I'm curious, yeah. From the outside of the technological realm, whether there was a representative sample of content creators there who were, you know, like, for example, I believe, wasn't Liz Winstead, the creator of The Daily Show, was there? And, you know, to a lot of people, she might represent coming from Comedy Central, coming from Viacom, one of the largest media companies in the world, somebody who might hold the standard of an old media perspective.
I actually spoke to Liz, and I believe we'll be playing a clip of that short interview. But
why don't we get a listen to them now?
Yeah, okay, that'll be great. I'm here with Liz Winstead, the co-creator of The Daily Show and also of Shoot the Messenger. She's just given us a great talk about the importance of us actually getting out there and making videos ourselves and with respect to satire as well, and keeping watch on what's going on with our government. So, Liz, what would you say is the most important take-home from your talk today?
I think the most important take-home is if you're creative, if you see hypocrisy and abuse of power in any way, there's no longer an excuse to not say something.
Absolutely.
You have Twitter, you have existing video, you can pull, you have a video camera probably on your phone, on your computer, or in your hand. Yeah. So there's no way for you to not have a say in the discussion. That is really the big message, is that everyone has a say, now everyone has a platform. No more excuses.
And the first morning I spoke to Mark Sermon and Chris Blizzard from Mozilla after their talk on the future of open video and what were the most important things they felt were the take-home messages from their talk.
I guess the most important thing is that the future of the internet and the future of open video are completely intertwined. And so if you care about the internet, you really need to care about open video, whether that means the technology behind open video, which is something that we are really involved in, or all of the kind of legal issues around content, or all the issues about just kind of creative and participatory production. So that's what this event is. It's about all of those things, which is great. And, you know, the takeaways that we gave at the end of our talk were, if we want to make sure that the world of online video is as open as the web is now, we need to make the right technology choices, all of us do. We need to make sure we move the market so that, you know, out there most of the video or all the video online is using open formats. And really, we just need to make great stuff that shows what open video can do. And, you know, this is the group of people to do it.
And finally, I spoke to Josh Silver, who is the executive director of Free Press, which is a media reform organization, about the importance of getting people to participate, to keep an eye on big corporations who have a lot of money to spend on having their voice heard, and why it's important for us to keep an eye on them.
Well, the most important thing is to keep in mind that despite the positive changes in the Obama internet and media technology platform, there are still enormous amounts of corporate money that are pushing for policies that are directly counter to the public interest. Yeah. And we're talking about levels of lobbying and campaign contributions that are on par with the military industry and the pharmaceutical industry, coming from the tech and media sectors. So that means that the only thing that's going to make the public interest prevail is if the public stays involved, if they continue to track these issues, if they continue to call Congress, call the FCC, write letters, and get involved, tell their neighbors, talk about it at their churches, at their baseball games, whatever. Because if these issues continue to be quiet and people don't pay attention, then the companies with the fattest wallets are going to continue to prevail.
I think one thread that I certainly came away with, as someone who's not, you know, completely technical in any way, shape or form, was that it's everyone's job in this day and age to have their voice heard. And, you know, open video is such a good way of doing that. There's the tools out there to speak out about things which are important. For example, you know, keeping an eye on what's going on in government regulation, keeping an eye on what's going on in big corporations, creating new forms of artwork even, you know, it's all important that everyone gets involved. And for me, that was a very, was it obviously a very feel-good message.
And I don't know if this was such a big topic of the conference, but was the idea of like being able to take media and remix it and collaborate on it in that way, was that anything? That was
it did come up, and they were playing videos of where this had actually happened and how, you know, fruitful and worthwhile new art has been created from doing this. And all the logistical problems with copyright and those elements of things in when that is done. And I think it's one of the huge debates of today.
If people will be willing to let go of the copyright of their stuff, even, you know, not necessarily let go of, you know, having their media copyrighted to begin with, but at least not press charges or demand that people take down content.
Absolutely. Well, what happens when, you know, an artist's piece is remixed and it makes it even bigger for them, you know, and it turns out to be a very beneficial thing, but technically
increasing their prestige by complimentary goods, you know, using the remix as a complimentary good to create more economic incentive for the original artist. I don't know. I mean, certainly the driving people towards a more top, you know, bottom up model was definitely an overwhelming theme, an overarching theme of the entire conference, which I think is to be expected given, you know, who was speaking in the general, you know, I mean, they definitely went into it with that in mind as being one of the things that they wanted to push for.
And it wasn't just being discussed in terms of a video. I think Matt Mason used the example of Nike's trainers, and apparently the best-selling sneaker brand for Nike is the one that was originally just completely white, and people customized their own. And Nike embraced this idea, and now the idea of, you know, letting people customize sneakers is a huge, you know, trend. And then there was someone who copied the idea in Japan and you know, practically made the same sneaker, but, you know, sold for a much higher price, but they were still very desirable. And, you know, he's allowed to do that. And so it's changing the way I think that corporations look at how their stuff is used and controlled.
I'm curious about that because it, you know, it seems like such a bright and like wonderful future. The idea that I can, and I would love to say that I can grab a piece of video and if I suddenly get inspired by it, be able to change it and feel comfortable doing that and have that relationship with a content creator that I could use their stuff in that way. But I wonder if there's any sense that content creators, you know, have a right to be concerned about what's happening to their content and, how the laws might change.
I think that there was an example that I came across in a class last year, and it was about a photographer who took a picture during one of the wars in South America, and it became a very iconic image of a man with a grenade, and it was reproduced everywhere. everywhere. People turned it into various forms of artwork, you know. And the thing that was lost from that is the actual story that the photographer was telling behind that picture. It just became this image. And personally, I feel it's a very valid thing for an artist to be able to protect their work. It's a huge dilemma, though, with, you know, moving on, though, and letting people create and add with someone else's work.
Because the economic case, from what I'm hearing, is like it really leans in the direction of sharing. And overwhelmingly, if somebody takes my content and makes it their own, and then spreads that around, it's more likely to exponentially and virally spread around, and I get the notoriety. Whether or not I definitely get the money is dependent on, you know, the market that I create or the economic model that I'm using, but at least my name gets out there. But like you're saying, if it's something that I have, there's a meaning behind the product and I want to preserve that artistic integrity, then the sharing model is totally not for me.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that there weren't a lot of people there advocating, you know, total overhaul of the copyright system. Although I will say I did not sit, I you know, unfortunately missed the lecture by Tony Falzone from Stanford, which was basically all about fair use. But even, I mean, I don't think that there were a lot of people who were sitting there talking about reform of the legal regime. Obviously, the kind of big area in this is how much weight fair use as a doctrine in copyright law will be able to carry, how much of a creative outlet it will allow, and whether you can redefine a fair use, whether fair use can evolve as a theory to support the need for more creative expression that is protected with that affirmative defense. So I know that I spoke with Tony after he got out of his session, and he is this guy who's, you know, works in a lot of these fair use cases. And one of the more interesting things that he was talking about was they had this case, RDR Books v. Rowling, where some guy, some librarian, kids librarian who really, really loved Harry Potter came up with a series of came up with something called the Harry Potter Lexicon, and it was an encyclopedia of all the Harry Potter creators and, or I'm sorry, characters and places and everything else. And it went to court, and the guy, the lexicographer, lost. It was not counted as a derivative work, so that Rowling could not sue for it being a derivative work, which you wouldn't normally think of. You would think that if it has all the Harry Potter characters, all the Harry Potter place and everything else, that would be a derivative work of the Harry Potter series. But it turns out that the judge says, no, it's not. Now, the guy lost because he was basically copying word for word the descriptions, and so of the places and the characters and everything. So that was what made it a copyright infringement case. But it is interesting to watch the fair use doctrine evolve, not quite from the bottom up or the top down, but from somewhere in the middle. It's just sort of expanding at present time and allowing more creative expression to be protected by fair use in a way without really any prescriptive regulatory changes, without any overthrow of, you know, vast overthrow of precedent or anything like that. It's just sort of kind of evolving and interacting slowly. Yeah.
Somewhere between complete openness and complete closeness.
Yeah, you just
got
get
fair
more.
Use. This ancient idea,
right,
coming in to bridge the gap yet again.
But I think also one thing that I did get from the conference was that there's a need to educate people who are putting work up there, who are remixing things. I was listening to Corinne McSherry, who's a senior staff attorney at the EFF, and she was giving some very hands-on tips about if you want to remix or make open video or do things, you know, here are some guidelines as to what to do so that you don't, you know, get caught out. And I know at Berkman that we've just in the process of releasing the video about guides for bloggers. And it's important, I think, one message that I really did take home was that, brilliant, let's get everyone contributing, let's get people participating, but people need to know, people need to be aware of the law and, you know, how to stay within the guidelines as they can. And the conference did speak to that, which I thought was very helpful.
Well, it sounds like, yeah, there's a lot of different angles, and I hope that, I'm not sure. Maybe it's great that there were a lot of angles and they didn't come to any kind of real, you know, agreement about, like, we're a movement now. We have to go forward and do things. We're so, like, always oriented in that way, where we have to all agree
and herding together,
get under the same umbrella and do something. But just to get some people in the same room talking about something like this sounds like it was a great accomplishment.
Yeah, it was a very diverse group of people, you know, speaking on many different topics. And it was, you know, whilst may not coming out with one message, it was incredibly useful to hear lots of different voices.
Thank you guys very much for joining me.
Thanks very much, Dan.
Thank you.
Catherine White and Chris Peterson are research interns at the Berkman Center, and Honor Asher is the Berkman Center's program coordinator. You can follow all of their work at the Berkman Center's website, cyber.law.harvard.edu. You can also find information, including videos, audio, and blog posts from the Open Video Conference at openvideoconference.org. Catherine White gathered those terrific interview clips from the Open Video Conference you heard midway through the show. Thanks, Catherine, and we hope to have you back again. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Boston. Venu de la verrerie, toujours la vérité, et ce marbre seul dans ses vies.